Service led by Pastor Alex Robertson. On Radio 4 FM, Nancy Crane reads another extract from Diane Hales' new book, investigating the real woman behind Leonardo da Vinci's most famous painting, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered.
One morning in Florence, I awaken in an apartment I've rented to the exultant sounds of drums and trumpets. I dash from one window to another, trying to locate the source, away from the Arno, it seems, towards Santa Croce. I join excited groups of people rushing through the neighborhood. From every direction, musicians, competitors from all of Tuscany for a regional prize, someone tells me, are converging on the Piazza Santa Croce. As I scramble up the steps in front of the Franciscan Basilica for a better view, the bands strut into formation behind their hometown banners. A sea of bright colors and high-flying flags surges before me, and my imagination carries me back in time to another thrilling spectacle that Florentines once beheld in this same square. On February 7, 1468, Lorenzo de' Medici, grandson of Cosimo de' Medici and prince in all but title, hosted a giostra, a ceremonial joust in honor of both a recent military victory and his engagement to a Roman princess, who was not present. His father Piero and his mother took seats of honor in front of Santa Croce's then unfinished brick facade. Lucrezia Donati, a young married beauty rumored to be their son's lady love, may not have sat far from my perch. According to French chivalric tradition, Lorenzo fastened her scarf to his lance. On that long-ago morning, crowds squeezed onto benches set up along the piazza, while hundreds craned from the windows of the surrounding buildings. A thick layer of white sand covered the great rectangle, divided lengthwise with wooden rails, so galloping horsemen could have at each other at breakneck speed. With a roll of drums and a blare of trumpets, a white charger entered, bearing the unmistakable figure of Lorenzo de' Medici, supremely yet seductively ugly, in a white silk mantle embroidered in scarlet and a black velvet cap encrusted with rubies, diamonds, and pearls. At the center of his shield gleamed the famous Medici diamond, reportedly valued at the then equivalent of $1 million. Above his head fluttered a gorgeous standard of white taffeta, decorated in a poet's description, with a sun above and a rainbow below, and with a bay tree in the background and a quote from Virgil inscribed in gold. This was the creation of the wizardly artists in the bottega of Medici favorite Andrea Verrocchio. His most talented apprentice, the slim teenager named Leonardo da Vinci, would almost certainly have stood among the cheering throng. Even before the Florentines sensed the enormity of his genius, the boy from Vinci dazzled everyone he met with his remarkable good looks. Tall and wiry, with golden locks, dawn blue eyes, and fair skin, the young Leonardo, as the 16th century art historian Vasari put it, displayed great physical beauty, which has never been sufficiently praised. Was Leonardo gay? He never married or had children, surrounded himself with other handsome men, and doted on comely protégés throughout his life. But we know little else. The artist veiled the intimate details of his life with a curtain of discretion. Early biographers presented him as asexual. Leonardo would marry no mistress but painting, one wrote, nor beget any children but the works he performed. Perhaps the question should not be the nature of his orientation, but whether it made any difference to his works. When I ask the opinion of a gay art historian I know in San Francisco, he pauses before answering. "It may have mattered with a painting like the Mona Lisa," he says slowly. In Leonardo's eyes, she wasn't someone to be desired. He looked at her in a different way than other men. This may be one reason why he could paint her not as an object or an ideal, but as a fully realized human being. It was a perspective I had never considered. In Florence, surrounded by the soaring works of Giotto, Brunelleschi, Donatello, Masaccio, and so many other masters, young Leonardo breathed in the big ideas and grand visions that circulated in the air like cerebral oxygen. In Verrocchio's bottega, he saw them emerge in tangible form. The small-scale art factory turned out everything from paintings and statues to wood chests, coats of arms, candelabra, and special commissions, such as a 2-ton bronze globe hoisted amid the fanfare of trumpets and choral chants atop the cathedral dome. Here he would imbibe the spirit of a generation of innovators, the first to approach art from what we would call a scientific point of view. And here he would develop the habit of carrying a libricino, a pocket-sized notebook not much bigger than a pack of cards, so that whatever his eyes observed, his fingers immediately translated into images. When he first picked up a paintbrush, his talent astounded his teacher. According to Vasari, the wide-eyed angel that Leonardo added to Verrocchio's Baptism of St. John, now in the Uffizi Museum, so surpassed anything from the painter's own hand that he never touched colors again, angered that a boy understood them better than he did. In 1472, Leonardo progressed, along with Botticelli and Perugino, to membership of the Guild of Artists. Not long afterwards, the 20-year-old scrawled a rare expression of emotion on the back of a drawing of the Arno Valley. Sono contento. I am happy. Meanwhile, Mona Lisa's father, Anton Maria Gherardini, had just turned 28. Like an estimated third of the members of the Florentine elite, Anton Maria had no occupation but collected the rents and earnings of his rural estates, including a country house in San Donato, a small village about 20 miles south of Florence. His ancient pedigree, scorned during the era of the detested magnates, now qualified him as an eminently eligible suitor. The merchants and bankers who fancied themselves as Florence's new aristocracy coveted the one thing money couldn't buy, a noble lineage. Anton Maria's eye turned to one of the most beautiful flowers of Florence, Caterina Rucellai. Giovanni, her father, ranked as the third richest man in Florence, was as proud of spending his money as of earning it. There are two principal things men do in this world, he once declared. One is procreating. The other is building. The Rucellai, who spawned 26 households, did both extremely well. Anton Maria could have anticipated many potential benefits to the match. Doors might open, debts might be forgiven, lucrative appointments might be made. The wedding would have fated the young couple with merry exuberance. When Caterina soon became pregnant, Anton Maria delighted in the welcome news. But his all too fleeting joy soon turned to sorrow. She died in childbirth. Her husband donned a great mourning cloak that fell to the ground with a hood to cover his face. As he stood among weeping relatives in the Rucellai Chapel in Santa Maria Novella, Anton Maria Gherardini could never have anticipated how curiously the future would unfold. Born 2 years after her sister's death, Camillo Rucellai would also die young, leaving behind a baby son and another grieving widower, Francesco del Giocondo, Anton Maria's future son-in-law. In 1478, some disgruntled Florentines, led by the Pazzi, a rival banking clan, decided the time was right for a coup against the Medici. The Pope offered covert support. Anton Maria, far removed from Florence's internecine politics, would have known nothing of this. Focused on family concerns, the widower had taken another bride, Lucrezia di Caccia, from a well-established Chianti family. He settled with his wife in the little house on smelly Via Squazzo, oblivious to impending cataclysm. In one of history's minor consequences, the Pazzi conspiracy and the war it triggered would devastate his family's finances and jeopardize the Gherardini future. On the morning of April 26, 1478, in the immense domed cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore, Lorenzo de' Medici took a place just to the right of the high altar for Sunday Mass. His brother, Giuliano, who came in late, stood some 20 yards further back. Just before the holiest moment in the sacred liturgy, a handbell chimed to herald the elevation of the communion host. At this signal, as Lorenzo and Giuliano bowed their heads, four men pulled out their daggers. "Die, traitor," one cried, plunging his blade into Giuliano's chest. Two priests just behind Lorenzo lunged at him with their knives, but the agile athlete, only slightly grazed, spun away. Wrenching off his cloak, he swirled it over his arm to form a shield and drew his sword. His friends rushed to his side and swept him away into the sacristy, barring the door. "Popolo e libertà," the Pazzi yelled, expecting the confused congregation to rally to their cause. Instead, as Lorenzo showed his face, The Florentines shouted their support for the Medici. A rabid crowd then swamped the conspirators and hung them from the windows of the Signoria. The artist Michelangelo, just 3 at the time, recalled his father hoisting him onto his shoulders in the square below for a better view of the dangling bodies. At one point, 16 corpses hung from the windows. Another 68 disemboweled bodies swelled and rotted in the piazza below. In all, 217 Florentines died. Lorenzo confiscated all the Pazzi's property and exterminated the family name, forbidding anyone even to pronounce it. The Pope's retribution was swift. He excommunicated Lorenzo and the entire city of Florence and ordered the seizure of all Medici assets in Rome, including the family bank. Then he formed an alliance with the King of Naples, and their troops marched into Chianti. The invading army set fire to crops, plundered houses, and trampled across the Gherardini and other estates, sacking the mill and stealing the harvest. For love of war, Anton Maria Gherardini scrawled angrily on his tax statement that year, "I have no income. Our houses have been burned, our possessions smashed, and our workers and livestock lost." When his wife became pregnant later that year, Anton Maria would have new reasons for worry. If the child was a girl, he would not have enough money to set aside a dowry at her birth. No groom would want her. No clan would welcome her. The very existence of an unmarried daughter at home, even if she retreated to the upper floor of her father's palazzo, would reduce her relative's honor and status. "Maritate o monacate, marry or become a nun," Tuscans exhorted their daughters. However fetching her face or her figure, Anton Maria Gherardini might have feared that, without a dowry, his girl would have to live out her days in eternal anonymity behind convent walls. He could not have been more mistaken about the fate awaiting his daughter. At the octagonal marble font in the baptistry, the godparents of the youngest Gherardini renounced Satan and declared belief in God in the baby's name. In the chill of the towering hall, the priest sprinkled holy water on the infant girl. With this blessing, her soul entered the kingdom of God, perhaps the only residence Florentines of the time would choose over their city. When the priest asked how the child would be called, the godparents intoned her first name, Lisa, a tribute to Anna Maria's mother who had died a few years before. I feel a compelling urge to see the actual record for myself. Don't waste your time looking through baptismal ledgers in Florence, an archivist advises. You can find it online when you get back home. With some trepidation, on my return to California, I take up the challenge, still daunting to me, of digging through vast Italian digital archives. I search for the baptismal registries in Florence. Zeroing in on the ledger for June 1479, I hit the key to visualizzare the list and hold my breath. With abracadabra swiftness, a page of names written in the small, florid script I'd first encountered in the Florence State Archive materializes on my screen. 6 lines below the date heading, I spot the name. Lisa Camilla de Anton Maria Gherardini. Leaping out of my chair, I dance in excitement. More than 500 years later, in a country yet to be discovered at the time of her birth, I have found the original record of Mona Lisa's entry into the world. The Donna Vera has never seemed more real to me.
Nancy Crane was reading from Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered by Diane Hills. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Brill production for BBC Radio 4.
As part of Front Row's ongoing festival coverage this week, tonight I'll be talking to stand-up comedian Sarah Pascoe about her new show here in Edinburgh, which looks at sexual politics through the ages. Also, poet and playwright Sabrina Mahfouz tells me about Chef, her acclaimed new play set in the kitchen of a women's prison. Why Scottish doctors are turning to poetry to help their bedside manners. And why comedian Phil Jupitus is leading a series of art classes for festival early risers. Join me, John Wilson, for Front Row Radio 4 this evening at 7:15.
Coming up after the news, it's Woman's Hour with Jenny Murray.